This podcast is brought to you by Viva Global. Experience the difference with Viva. You are listening to FNR Football Nation Radio.
Hey, welcome to another edition of Talking Fußball, the Bundesliga show, your source for all things German football. I'm your host, Matt Herman. This week, we are tying up loose ends in unbelievable fashion. We're taking care of our end-of-season awards in a way that many thought was impossible. Because, you know, in a world where Erste FC Union Berlin are in the Bundesliga, we can't rule anything out. With me this week is Abel Meisterosch, who was very pleased to see Union win. Not only because he loves underdogs, he loves the scrappy types. But why again? Maybe because you put a lot of work into a few Union-related things.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of reasons. I mean, I've been reading Uli Hesse's Tor, you know, the Bible again, which I think everybody should be. But there was some talk about Union, and you know, got into some of the history there. And, you know, I didn't really know too much about them until a few weeks ago. And I figured, you know, I enjoyed their history because it's so much like Hungarian history, which is basically just bleak and things just go horribly wrong. So I found some sort of sympathies there with Union. And then it's also Stuttgart. So it's like, you know, Stuttgart, I can't really make fun of Hamburg anymore because it's just cruelty at this point. So, but making fun of Stuttgart is one of the few things that I have left. And so it was kind of natural for me to gravitate towards Union. And then, you know, our mutual friend, Ras Dunbar, is another one that, and then I think somebody else wrote to me an email after I wrote about Union at the Bundesliga Bulletin. So, and then I think also I visited the Altenfesterei. So I guess it's those things. I mean, you have some connections to Berlin and Union, right? I mean, not that.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, obviously, you support Hertha, but.
Oh yeah, but I've been to Union a number of times. I like it there. You know, this is going to be a Union love-in episode, at least in part. Though we will have plenty more coverage of Berlin's second biggest team, as well as, you know, a few ways of looking back at the season that was coming up on Talking Fußball. All right, here we go with part one of Talking Fußball, the part where we usually talk about, you know, the best of the match day that was. But to be honest with you folks, there was no match day in the Bundesliga to talk about. There was a couple of sort of special fixtures, though. There was, of course, the relegation playoff, which, you know, featured Union Berlin and VfB Stuttgart over two legs, as well as the big one-off Pokal Finale, that was, you know, RB Leipzig and FC Bayern München. We're going to talk about both of those, but I think really the place where we want to start, which is where all the excitement is, as far as I'm concerned, over the last 24 hours, that is all about Union. Union Berlin. A team who has never been in the Erste Bundesliga before. A team whose history is really sort of checkered with a lot of disappointments, both in the East Germany, DDR-Zeit period, as well as in the sort of modern, you know, unified Germany Bundesliga period. They finally got over the hump. I have a lot of friends back in Berlin who are very, 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 very excited about this news. So, you know, from that perspective, I'm into it. But this is actually a really special thing in lots of ways. I mean, let's talk about some of the reasons why Union going into the top flight is sort of an event that almost all sort of neutral fans can really get pretty psyched about. I mean, where would you like to start?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, I guess we could start with, like, the atmosphere and just sort of the sort of extracurricular stuff around the football, which is, I guess I'm probably wrong to call it extracurricular because it's a huge part of it. And that's probably where Union are definitely first division for a long time now, just in the Altenfesterei, one of the best stadiums that I've been to, just has that, you know, basically mostly terrace. I mean, and there's some, and it's just very intimate, and it's, you know, I mean, you could see this in especially in the 0-0 game where it's just basically smoke everywhere and just crazy atmosphere, and it, you know, although it wasn't a great game, but probably inside it felt like the best game ever, and then even like you saw some of the videos from before, you know, of how they were welcoming the team, the fans, how they traveled in other places. Just kind of, you know, just the way it is. And you know, I think when I was researching, I wrote a brief history of Union Berlin on the Bundesliga Bulletin, and just looking at like the videos of the supporters pitching money in and coming up and shoveling snow and really helping with the renovations of the stadium. And this is a club that, in talking about the history of it, I mean, it was a club that, you know, had so many splits, it was really hard to keep track of it. I mean, just even when they were formed early on, you know, and it was just different names with SC Olympia. And then I guess like the biggest difference is that it's a working class clubs and you know, football, especially in the early parts in Germany, as Uli Hesse always reminds us, was not a working class thing. It was a middle class thing. It was, you know, people who could afford to do the English thing. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, it was about the Turnen and the athletics in Germany in the early parts. And this Union club was the working class club. And Berlin, I mean, you could probably talk about all the historic clubs of Berlin. I mean, it's probably over 10 how many football clubs that there were, right?
Yeah. And it's interesting, I mean, considering the history of the many, many clubs of Berlin, I mean, in that German football used to be separated into regions. And before the Bundesliga, you know, the champion of each region would sort of face off against the champion of another region, and there'd be a playoff, and the, you know, Deutscher Meister, which was, you know, the German championship, was not decided by a league format. It was a regional tournament format. And Berlin for many, many years had its own sort of regional pod, as it were. So the weird thing though, I mean, even though some of that stuff lies in the, you know, after the split of East and West Germany, where Union was not participating in those at various points in time. But in the long history of clubs within Berlin, if you had to pick a team who you thought would be, you know, the one who would eventually stabilize as the second biggest club in the city after Hertha, who have for the most part been the biggest club in the city for a very long time, it would be really, really unlikely for you to choose Union, considering at various points in time there have been, you know, investors in other clubs, or there have been, you know, let's just say sponsors or you know, sort of government sugar daddies to various clubs. I mean, the sort of thing that hangs over Union's history. And very interestingly, one of the most, you know, charming tweets that I saw following Union's, you know, promotion to the league featured an elderly man who had been, you know, a member of the club for 50 years. He said he'd been, you know, going since he was a kid. He had, you know, coached them at the youth level back in the 70s, you know, and as he was trying to tell his story and the story of the club, this was to a Radio Eins, I guess, you know, journalist, he was basically a radio journalist from Berlin. Without the journalist even asking him, he brought up the fact that some of the best players who he coached, including Falco Götz, who of course went on to play for, you know, Hertha and other clubs and coach Hertha and could, you know, play in all over Germany, was that, you know, as soon as players became any good, the BFC Dynamo, which was the team that was sort of the dominant team of the East German period, the team who was most sort of closely aligned with the government, with the Stasi, the secret police, would basically take all the best players and put them on BFC Dynamo. So there is a permanent chip on the shoulder of Union Berlin fans that they were always sort of disadvantaged, that they were always the outsider club. You know, being an Union fan in the period of the divided Germany, being an Union fan was something of a political statement. It either was an explicit political statement saying, I am anti-government, or it was a sort of more implicit one saying that, you know, I'm a simple person. I am for my neighborhood. I am for my factory. I am for my, you know, community, and not for some idea of socialist paradise as promoted by, you know, the SAD or what have you. It was a very grounded thing to be. And that ethic of sort of oppositionalism and that ethic of underdog culture has like gone through that this entire club. I mean, even, you know, the wall has now been down longer than it was up. And that sort of ethic of going against the grain is still imbued in this club, and it's such a cool thing.
Yeah, and I mean, I was drawing like parallels to Hungarian history, not just because of the sort of horrendousness of it or the unluckiness of it, but also because, you know, Hungary also went through the socialist period, and it was much the same way, where, you know, Ferencváros here was sort of the independent club, which actually was pretty successful ahead of it. And then, you know, we had sort of the same sort of, you know, police had the police, the army, you know, so which is much the same experience in most of the countries that underwent this experience of socialism during the Cold War and onwards. And in that sense, I think that that's probably the key, is that you accepted, you know, if you were an Union Berlin fan or if you were a fan of some other team, that you know, like, you didn't have a chance to win. And you mentioned Erich Mielke, who was the Stasi chief there, and he was on the BFC Dynamo board. And I just love this anecdote that I think a lot of people have written. But basically, in the late 70s, when Dresden was the team to beat with Matthias Sammer and his father Klaus Sammer, at one point I think they had won most of the titles back then. And at one point, Erich Mielke just walked in on them as they're celebrating the title. I think it's in 78. And he was just like, okay, it's our time to win. And from then on, they won the next 9 championships because they were just outright like buying referees and getting calls and I think not to turn this into a history lesson, but that's one of the difficulties of living in socialism. I mean, I myself have only experienced the last dying years of it in Hungary, but that sort of atmosphere of you can't win and there's nothing you can do, but you also have to kind of keep living. And one of the ways people keep living is through football. It's through sports. I mean, sports is this microcosm, right, of life. And I think in that way, being an Union Berlin supporter and going out there and playing these games against like a BFC Dynamo and going out there and saying, calling them pigs and talking about, that's one way where you could express yourself. So there's little cracks through the system where, football has always been that way, where you can kind of get away with more. Like you would probably never get away with that kind of criticism of the regime. Maybe in the late 80s as it was falling apart, but at the football match, it was all in the context. And it was just a lot of this wink, wink and defining yourself in opposition to the regime. So I can definitely identify with that. That's probably the part that grabbed me, at least in that history. And there's all these stories of like the 1968 UEFA Cup when they finally won the East German, when they finally, like, they've had this crazy run. They beat Zwickau, who were the holders, and then Vorwärts Berlin, which is another fantastic name for a team, which is literally Forward Berlin. I guess that's the army team. And then Carl Zeiss Jena. And then they wanted to go to the UEFA Cup, but then the Prague Spring of 1968 happens, and they were drawn to I think Dynamo Moscow. And basically, just those games were called off because they were drawn, I think, against a Yugoslavian team, and then the German FA of the DDR basically just withdrew them. And so it's just one of those things where, like, the one time they could have had some success, the regime intervenes again, and I think that's what made this very personally touching for me.
Yeah, I think also, I mean, even taking things sort of forward from the Ostblock time, Union Berlin have also had a pretty checkered history. They've, had serious money problems a couple of times since the reunification of Germany. They've had, a couple of campaigns by fans to sort of keep them solvent. One which involved a pretty famous march through the city, another one which involved, the stadium renovations being done actually by hand by the supporters. I mean, in that this is a workers' club, there are a lot of, tradesmen, construction workers who support this club. So it wasn't like they were just handing this over to complete amateurs. There was a lot of people who actually knew exactly what they were doing when it came to building things. And they also have a really interesting relationship to, growing into this status as sort of the second club of Berlin. Right when the wall came down and there was sort of a sense of euphoria about where Germany was headed, they were the team that, Hertha played against in a friendly to sort of, mark a bit of a, reunified Berlin celebration. And it looked like it might be a rosy future for these two teams. That has not exactly borne out. I guess if you are the second biggest club in a city, it is, one of the things that you dream of is to get a crack at the biggest club in the city. So I think the Berlin Derby next year, which will be the first time there has been a Berlin Derby between these two sides in the Erste Bundesliga, the first time in, 42 years, I think, since there's been any Berlin Derby. They did play each other a couple of times when Hertha were down in the second division earlier in this decade. But I think that's going to be a really enticing matchup because this is not a bitter sort of, you know, pitched battle in the streets kind of rivalry. I don't necessarily see this being a, you know, violent crowd trouble type rivalry. I mean, I've only ever been to one Berlin derby in the second division. Unfortunately, it was the one that Hertha lost at home. But it's hugely spirited. There is genuine, you know, sort of feelings of self-identification between the two sets of fans that they feel, you know, very strongly that they are not the other. So I'm looking really forward to seeing these games. I really actually hope to go back to Germany and see one of these games.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's on everybody's like top of their wish list of next year's fixtures. And I've talked to some of the Hertha fans and nobody really feels any like ill will. And I think that's kind of back and forth. And I think this is the other weird thing about German football in general, and weird in a good way, because, you know, like if you look at across Europe, and every major capital city has like 3, 4, 5 teams. And Germany has been different that way. And you know, not to insult you, but I mean, Hertha hasn't been significant in Bundesliga at all. And now you have two, but it's still, it's a great story. And I think that will make it interesting. And I mean, we'll see how the games work out, because, you know, I mean, I've watched a few Union games this season, just kind of preparing for the relegation battle and then just looking at the Zweite Liga in a little bit more detail. And I would say it's the results have been great, and defensively they've been excellent. But I mean, some of the games, like, I think they either play like really hard to watch kind of draws, or maybe they eke out a win. And then, you know, maybe once every 2 or 3 games, you'll see them play like kind of like more open, like the 2-2 in the first relegation round against Stuttgart, the first leg.
So in a lot of ways, the home leg, the 0-0 draw, which I think anyone but an Union fan will agree was extremely tough viewing. That was in some ways more typical of Union's style of play.
Yeah, and it's weird because the Zweite Liga, like the teams that got promoted are very much different than this, like Köln and Paderborn. Every match was, you know, 9 goals somewhere. And then, yeah, I think it reminded me a little bit of like the less successful Hamburg matches under Hannes Wolf this season, or, you know, some of the other ones. And you could clearly see that there are some talent issues there. And like, you know, Sebastian Andersson had like 50 challenges in the first leg and 35 in the return leg. And I tweeted out the aerial duels. So like, I think 204 was the number that Stuttgart and Union played in the 0-0 match. There were 204 aerial duels. And I think they each won like 50 each or something, 52, 50. I was looking at the totals for the Bundesliga. And I think like the Zweite Bundesliga Magdeburg had 60. And that's kind of the total that they averaged. They lead the Zweite Liga, and Eintracht have like 46, and both teams were over 100 in this game. I mean, just to give you an idea of what kind of match this was.
It was a lot of big beefy dudes banging into each other is what it was.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it was just like, I mean, if there, this was, for one thing, it was a great advertisement for some sort of concussion protocol to be instituted, because what poor Holger Badstuber had to go to, and Ozan Kabak. And I was pitching the idea to our mutual friend Ross Dunbar that they should have some sort of video with Sebastian Andersson and Dolph Lundgren, to where it's just like some boxing video where like, because, you know, like anytime you're gonna face Andersson in the air, like someone's gonna get bloodied, and it's usually the other guy. And just have these guys, like, maybe they can ask Badstuber and Kabak and maybe Askasibar as well to play a part. But I mean, that guy was just battering everybody, and I mean, like, just must be like a nightmare to play against.
Yeah, sort of moving on to like where you think Union might stack up in the Erste Bundesliga. As far as I'm concerned, from what I have seen, both in these two sort of relegation playoff legs against a bad first division team, as well as the snippets of you know, Zweite Liga action that I saw from the season, they have a lot of work to do as far as strengthening this squad. Is there really even a way that they can realistically improve enough to stay in the league? Or is financially that probably going to be really tricky for them to even accomplish?
Yeah, I mean, like their Transfermarkt squad value was like 23 million. And when I looked at sort of the arrivals, I mean, half the people are starters, so like Hübner, Abdullahi, Robert Zui, Gikiewicz, the keeper, Ken Reichel, Schmiedebach, and Andersson. These are, I mean, I guess Schmiedebach is on loan, but that's like 7 guys, and all of them, and Joshua Mace is another one, semi-starter. But so like 8 or 9 of their guys just came last summer, and this is combined cost of 2.3 3 million for like 9 guys. But the one positive is that, you know, they can probably pick up some of those guys who don't want to go down from like a Nürnberg, or, you know, or like maybe pick up some of the guys from Stuttgart even. But the problem with them is that I don't think they're going to be offering enough wages. So what I would be doing, you know, is looking at some of the younger guys, like taking out, you know, it's just typical sort of promotion team is like taking out the players from Dortmund or Bayern on loan, or like the same thing, like Robert Zui, I think, is a nice example. Like, he's a pretty creative number 8, number 10 from Hoffenheim, and you know, taking on more of those kind of guys who won't get a playing time, like, you know, let's say Christoph Baumgartner is a young guy at Hoffenheim who's played a couple times, and, you know, we're not sure if he's going to play next season, but maybe take him on loan and you know, take a shot, because you need to have some sort of plan, like, you know, or like even like Carlos Mané that they took, I think, I guess now he's at Sporting, but former Stuttgart player. So those kind of chances, because they, you know, keep in mind, like, they've sold a lot of their, like, you know, bigger players, like, you know, Steven Skripsky, even the great Bobby Wood.
The great.
You know, when he had that. Maybe, I mean, you can't get him back, I guess, because you can't. That's the problem, is that you're not going to be able to afford his wages. And what would you get in return? So it's going to be tough. But, you know, I like Urs Fischer. I've heard some nice things about him. I like what he does. You know, it's a very organized team. And you know, I think maybe what their hope is that, you know, they can be the team that plays. Like, I think Hannover, you know, when they got promoted with Brian Heiter is a nice blueprint for them. You know, like, nobody really expected much of them, and they played solid defensively, pressed high, and there's some stuff there. I like Abdullahi Anderson, definitely can cause havoc, because, you know, if he's dominating like Mark Oliver Kempf or even Kabak or Bachstuber as well, I mean, I think a lot of the other Bundesliga center backs are gonna have some problems with him. And they're defensive solid. I mean, that's the great thing about them, is that Gikiewicz, who came from Freiburg, was the best keeper in the Zweite Liga, had like, I think, 14 clean sheets, and Union basically giving up less than a goal a game. With guys like Hübner. And then there's some playmaking there, I think with Friedrich, Marvin Friedrich, who I quite like. And, you know, set pieces are going to be big. I mean, they're already doing a lot of that with Trimmel. So there's something there. I think sometimes they don't always take advantage of what it might be there, but obviously this was not the time or place to try stuff. And, you know, they're going to have 34 games to experiment and to try new things. And, you know, I think a lot of those other teams that have players who are young players who want to get a chance, you know, let's say a Laszlo Benes, who's at Gladbach, but doesn't get a chance, and he's alone to Kiel. Like, wouldn't he go there and be a playmaker? And, you know, I think that's their main attraction is, you know, offering first Bundesliga. But their main problem is being able, and this is me knowing too much about their books, obviously, but I would have trouble foreseeing how they can afford sort of heavy wages.
Yep. I think you're right in saying that they are doing things right. I mean, as you said, the players who they brought in last summer, most of them have been useful, good players, and they have figured out a way to get useful, good players for not very much money. It's just a matter now of finding that next sort of higher class of useful, good players who don't cost very much. And, you know, every level you go up higher, the harder it becomes to find useful players for not very much money. Let's talk about Stuttgart for a little bit before we, you know, leave this relegation playoff aside. I mean, obviously, this has been a disastrous season for them. After things had looked up in a big, big way at the end of last season, where they went on that sort of amazing run under Typhoon Korkut. And it looked like the decision to, you know, replace Hannes Wolf with Korkut had paid off, that they were on a good path. They brought in a lot of very good or sort of highly touted players in the off season, but it all just really blew up in their face. What do you see as the biggest factor in why that plan didn't work?
Well, just no stability, right? Like you mentioned, I mean, I think people were trending with the Dietrich Kraus hashtag on Twitter,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, this is the sort of chairman, CEO type who really changed things.
Yeah. And I mean, like, we could play a trivia game of, can you name all the 11 coaches that they've had since Bruno Labbadia left in 2013? It's 6 years, but I know it'd be a great, maybe that's a great trivia question for the listeners. But yeah, I mean, I think they were somewhat ready for this and succumbed to their fate, maybe when they started hiring, you know, Sven Mislintat, and then they already hired Tim Walter, who I really like,
yeah,
and Kiel as their head coach next season, and just a fresh start, because like you mentioned, it was, I somehow managed to chug down a gallon of the corporate Kool-Aid during the summer, and against my better judgment, because I think as regular listeners of the show know, I'm certainly not the biggest Typhoon Korkut fan, but somehow convinced myself that because of the summer signings that Reschke, the now departed Michael Reschke, who's now trying his luck at Schalke 04 next season, which might turn out horribly wrong as well. Did he sign those guys, you know, like Gonzalo Castro, Didavi, and what you like to call as the assembling the 2009 All-Stars with Denis Aogo and Gettner and Bachtuber and those guys who, you know, have names, but there doesn't seem to be a plan. Like I wrote about the Vine Zero era in that 6-0 loss against Augsburg. I watched actually a few of their games and in some of their games they looked okay. I mean they hung tough with Leipzig and Düsseldorf and even against Bayern for 55-40 minutes. And it's there is that kind of, it's like they have two different teams, right? Like there's a team that's young and wants to counterattack, and then there's the other team that plays slow and plays long balls to Gomez, and then, you know, what I didn't understand about them even in these two relegation games is like you have Pavard, Kabak, and Marco Lürkämpf, who are three like excellent ball playing center backs. And who's going to do the playmaking? It's going to be Gonzalo Castro dropping back and being the deep lying sort of right half space playmaker. Or like you're going to have like Denis Aogo trying 95 crosses, or like Insua, the same thing, or Gettner and Askasi. Like, so I don't think like that's their biggest problem, is that it doesn't seem like there's a clear idea of how they can utilize their talents. And they also like seems to just like bring in a lot of talented guys who are difficult, you know, or either like too young, or like Anastasios Donis, who, you know, is always late from every meeting and misses flights and, you know, all these kind of things. So, I mean, could this be turned around in one season with Mislintat and Tim Walter? I think, yeah. Is it going to be difficult? Surely, because, you know, you're going to have Hanover now, you're going to have HSV, you're going to have Nürnberg in the Zweite Liga, and then you still have, like, the Kiels and some of the other teams. So it's certainly, like, going to be probably the most competitive Zweite Liga. I mean, although this season was ridiculously competitive. So it's not going to be an easy task, but I think it's at once like really heart-wrenching for them, because, you know, they went down just a couple of years ago with the Kostic-Werner teams, and now they have to try to do it again. And I think they started that rebuild with Hannes Wolf, and I really enjoyed that team, and I thought Hannes Wolf got a raw deal. Now it turns out maybe Hannes Wolf is not that great after all, but I thought they should have continued on that path.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we can say Hannes Wolf is a good coach, or we can say he's not such a good coach, but whatever he was doing in the second division with Stuttgart was working.
Yeah.
And Stuttgart were on sort of a good path, which was a sort of, you know, let's clear out the you know, older and more expensive players in our squad. Let's get a young coach who can sort of grow with the team, and let's wait to make it happen. And it feels to me like, you know, everything went wrong when they sort of got off that path, when they sort of, you know, told Reschke he could go out and buy the 2009 All-Stars, when they sort of lost faith in Wolf as quickly as they did, despite being in something like 10th place. It just feels like this is a really great case study in what happens to a big club. And, you know, let's face it, Stuttgart are a big club. They're certainly, you know, a top 10, if not top 5 or 6 club in Germany in terms of fans and, you know, sponsorship revenue and all that. You know, a big club has a really hard time getting onto that slow rebuild timescale. I mean, there's always the temptation when you're a big club to sort of say, all right, we're in this first division again. Let's win now. And, you know, I really, really hope that this next time they do it, they have all the pieces in place to make it work. I mean, having Thomas Hitzlsperger, who is somebody who both seems to know what he's doing and has a sort of, you know, existing strong bond with supporters, with the media, is going to help. You know, having a coach who, you know, not only played successful but also attractive football with Kiel is going to help. But, you know, I just worry that if they do get things together and they get back into the first division, that there is going to be that impulse that, you know, someone's going to sit and think to themselves, huh, we're Stuttgart. We shouldn't be satisfied with a mid-table finish and have the house of cards fall down again.
Yeah, and I mean, I like Tim Belter. I've watched his Kiel teams, and then they do this like really interesting, like crazy style, because their center backs just like they either try to like dribble out with the ball, or they pass out and then kind of flip, turn out, and then go into midfield, and it's like super risky because, you know, his keepers played really high, so it's a wonderful like aesthetic, you know, thing to watch, but it also ends up in like ridiculous goals conceded sometimes. And I don't know if that necessarily, like, it works really nicely in a place like Kiel, because, you know, it's probably the lowest budget, and even in the Zweite Liga, it was, you know, I don't know if that's gonna necessarily fly in Stuttgart, but I really hope they try it, because it's like, it sure beats whatever the hell Korkut, you know, with his brand of bland football, and even Beinzierl, who just Weinzierl just changes formations for no reason, and does nothing really ever happens. And Niko Bilic actually, I mean, like, his team's actually made some sense, but nothing really worked out. So I hope it works out for them, because there is something there. It's just like my biggest thing is who's going to stay. I mean, we know that Ozan Kabak is the only one who doesn't have a contract for the Zweite Liga. And from what I understand, he can be bought out for 15 million. And it's attractive because, you know, if you can get past his defensive efficiencies, which he doesn't seem to be able to mark anybody in space, especially on set pieces. But, you know, he's 18 and physically, like, he's great. I mean, he stood up to Lewandowski pretty well. He's pretty good in build up. So there's definitely something there, and he's shown flashes, you know, and they still got, like, you know, I mean, I know Pavard is leaving, but they still got Baumgartl there, who's a young defender, Marc-Oliver Kempf, who I quite like. So there's a lot of pieces there. I just think they need to figure out a direction. And I hope that, I mean, there's seems to be implications that they are figuring out with Tim Belter and Mislintat, and maybe, you know, they could probably loan a few players from, you know, like a, you know, Dortmund or whatever, guys who need playing time. Maybe they can start the, you know, I mean, they don't have a right back, for example. So maybe this could be the, I mean, not counting poor Andreas Beck, but maybe this could be the time for Felix Paslak's revitalization. I mean, I think that the career of Felix Paslak needs to be saved by Tim Belter. I think that's what we need. So I've got that for next season as my number one goal.
Nice. That'll be the reason to tune into the Zweite Liga all season long. You know, just looking into your crystal ball real quick, you already mentioned it once, but maybe we can take a slightly closer look. There are four sort of quote-unquote big clubs in the Zweite Liga next year, which is the Stuttgart, Nuremberg, Hamburg, and Hanover. Hanover, by the way, have, you know, assembled the Jan Schlaudraff, sporting director, Mirko Slomka, you know, coach dream team that's in place for next season. I mean, I can see their thinking in doing that. I mean, these two guys were basically symbols of the last time Hanover were actually good. I mean, Slomka was the coach and Schlaudraff played.
Yeah, but what was the point of hiring Thomas Doll, like, when you knew you were going down?
I know. That's the thing that really, you know, drives me crazy. Like,
what do you think was going to happen?
Like, these guys were available 3 months ago, and they hired Thomas Doll instead, which, you know, shows that there's some kind of rudderlessness going on at Hanover. Are we basically of the mind that these four teams are going to sort of form the, you know, Zweite Liga race for next season? Are we cruelly leaving somebody out?
I don't know. I mean, I think probably not, because like, even Regensburg, who had, you know, Bayer Lotzer is not going to coach Köln. So they're losing him. Akil, who was another really good team, have lost their coach. So I think it's going to be tough for other teams to make it there. So I guess Heidenheim is probably the one we are leaving out, because, you know, we know and love Franz Schmidt there. So maybe they're going to be the ones who can just kind of get in there and kind of cause some ruckus there. But yeah, it's going to be a crazy Zweite Liga with Hamburg, you know, well, because all these teams are rebuilding. I mean, Nuremberg, I think there's a good chance that they're hiring Peter Hermann as a sporting director from Bayern, who was assistant coach there for a long, long time. And I think he was at Fortuna, if I'm not mistaken. So there's, you know, and they've re-signed some players like Matenia is going to stick around. I mean, it's interesting because it's like the fallen giants, you know, of yesteryear are all in the Zweite Liga.
Yeah, I don't necessarily see anybody outside of Heidenheim who have sort of been building towards something for a number of years, or, you know, perhaps Sankt Pauli. I guess my sort of sentimental side would like to see them do well, and I think that they're, you know, just as, you know, Union are happy to meet Hertha in the same division, Pauli are always happy to have another year with Hamburg in their division. Okay, we talked a lot about this relegation affair. I think we should turn our attention to an actual title that was handed out this weekend, one that was actually earned by Bayern. They got a 3-0 win in the DFB Pokal final over RB Leipzig, a team who gave them some fits in the league just a few weeks ago. But Bayern certainly found a way to sort of work around Leipzig's press. And, you know, they got a bit of, you know, good fortune in terms of finishing, whereas Leipzig did not. But I would hesitate to say that Bayern were anything other than deserved winners in the end of this one anyway. What did you make of this game?
Yeah, I think emphasis on in the end, because for the first 28 minutes, I mean, Leipzig's press was incredible. You know, it was the 4-2-2-2 of the RB style that, you know, the Rangnick and Roger
the
Schmidt.
The Hasenhüttl style.
Yeah, Roger Schmidt, I guess, is another one who is associated with that in Salzburg. And I mean, it was really good to see Tyler Adams, get a start after, you know, basically playing one game after a 7-week absence and just pressing. Like, Tyler Adams was like pressing the center back as a defensive midfielder. It's tremendous to see. And Bayern, you know, I mean, they're always going to try to build up, they're never going to just knock it long. And it didn't always work out. I mean, that was the thing. And then there was two chances that for Poulsen and I think for Werner, but Kimmich had two blocks. And then there was that corner that Poulsen had in I think it was around maybe the 5th minute or the 11th minute. I can't remember now. But when Neuer made this huge save, and then my colleague Szabolcs Kamenes, who's a goalkeeper and coach as well on the show, was doing a great job with the analysis, because he was saying that, like, Bayern's line on the corner was so deep, and there's nobody at the post. So Poulsen, they had like a two banks of four and five, and Poulsen was just in the middle with nobody around him and could just get a free header from 4 yards out. And Neuer made this incredible save, but it's just kind of a rough organization by Bayern, and maybe they just, you know, weren't prepared, or they took the corner kick quickly. And but I think the first time that they were actually a little bit fortunate was for that goal, because it might have been the first time that Alaba and Coman or any Bayern player on the wings was able to get a 2v1. And that's been the key to Bayern's season, is those 2v1s on the wing. I mean, that's been the key for a long time, but finally they were able to get one. And I think Adam switched off a little bit, Zabitzer was behind, and Alaba was able to get that cross, and then that Lewandowski header, I think, just changed the game. And Pulgulacsi, who you know, goalkeeper this season, had no chance. I think Billy Orban could have done a better job of staying closer to Lewandowski and not blocking Gulacsi's view. But that header was just like, you know, 99 players out of 100 will have no chance of even getting it on goal. And how he got that on, I didn't really understand. And then I think even in the second half, I mean, Leipzig came out and really had two big chances. I think Werner had won on the 47th, 48th. And then there was that Konate run, you know, Konate dribbling through the middle and releasing Forsberg. And you know, I think Neuer, I think, made a mistake not coming out and then had to make this tremendous save. I mean, if you saw the image of him basically just doing a split midair as he saved them.
Yeah, I think it came off his calf and his hand.
Yeah.
He made his body as big as he could.
Although I think Forsberg, who probably has the best first touch in the Bundesliga, actually took a poor touch for me and had to catch up to the ball and didn't give himself as much as time. And then I think, you know, Rangnick switched to that 3-4-3, and that did not work at all. We've seen Hertha have some success with the 3-4-3, and some of the other teams do that well, but Leipzig's for some reason didn't work too well. And you know, in the end, Lewandowski finished them off with that great muscle job on Upamecano, who for my money is probably, you know, one of the three most athletic guys in the Bundesliga, and just got crushed by Lewandowski. I mean, that was incredible. So it was a really weird win for Bayern, and, you know, Kovac is now getting the job guarantee, and Uli Hoeneß is saying that there was never a shred of doubt. Of course, I mean, you know, it's the most, just about the most Uli Hoeneß thing to say.
Yeah.
That, you know, for the whole year, like, everybody wants to fire the guy, and he's like, you know, never in doubt. I mean, I don't know what you think of that.
Yeah, I mean, as far as Lewandowski, you know, bodying off Dayot Upamecano, yeah. I mean, I think we all got about as good a look as we've ever gotten at the physique of Robert Lewandowski this weekend. If, you know, yeah. If anyone missed it, which I don't know how you could, you know, have a look on social media. It's quite the male physical form.
Things are out there almost.
Looking at Niko Kovac, I mean, I think you sort of treated this job guarantee with the requisite and correct amount of skepticism and cynicism. Is there any notion now that he has two titles in the bank and, you know, a fairly rousing comeback league title to go along with this cup win? Does he have a good degree of credit now? I mean, is he going to go into next season with any less of a cloud hanging over him? Or is this going to be another situation where, you know, if Bayern come out of the gate and don't lead the Bundesliga from day one, is he in the same spot where there's sort of, you know, chatter in the Bildzeitung every other week?
I think he is, just because of, like, just the way they've won it, which is both incredible as you know, overturning that deficit, but also, like, not always convincing. I mean, there's some great games in the Rückrunde there, but also, like, even though within those great games, it sometimes just looked like it was just individual difference. It was never, like, certainly I can't remember any game where it was just like the tactics were great, or, you know, he made some adjustments or whatever. And yeah, like, he joined this list of, like, being, I think, the first guy to win the double as a player and as a manager, I guess, you know. And I mean, that's incredible, and just getting those things. But Bayern's going to be very different next year. You know, Boateng has been given that friendly advice from Uli Hoeneß that, like, yeah, I think you should leave. You know? And I think, you know, they're going to bring in a bunch of guys. We already mentioned Pavard and Lucas Hernandez, and I think Werner is going to happen. I actually think one of Leroy Sané or Rodri from Atletico Madrid could also happen. So, you know, they're still going to have that huge advantage, but it's still going to be Niko Kovac. And we'll have to see, like, because some of the guys that have criticized them, you know, are leaving, the Ribéry's, the Robins, even Boateng for sure, Renato Sanchez, who, you know, didn't play a part. And those questions are still going to be there. And, you know, depending on how Dortmund, I mean, have strengthened their squad, Leverkusen going to be fairly strong as well with Demirbay and Leipzig with Nagelsmann. I mean, it's going to be a great Bundesliga next season.
Yeah. I mean, looking ahead at what Bayern are doing this summer, which is definitely going to be strengthening their squad in one way or another, as well as what Dortmund have already accomplished this offseason, getting Torgan Azar and Julian Brandt and, you know, Nico Schulz signed, and they're probably not quite done just yet. I mean, this was a close title race. I have no reason to think it's not going to be another close title race between those two teams. Do you think that, you know, Leipzig have enough to play a role in that race? Do you think that there might be another team who could sort of have a bit of a say in things, or is this going to be a two-horse race next season?
I think with Nagelsmann, you almost can guarantee that Leipzig will play a part, because his teams just always improve, you know, and I think this team's already pretty good. And I mean, the one thing I could see is that, you know, he had this big interview in Kicker, and he was saying that, like, he maybe doesn't want to be, like, ball dominant and possession oriented as much as he was. And I think, But then, like, we had an interview with Peter Gulacsi on the show, and he was asking about the questions about, you know, the challenges for him having to play for Nagelsmann and then needing a, you know, play goalkeeper with the distribution, and he seemed to indicate that his idea was that they are going to be more possession oriented, and that's been the one thing I think he also said it. I think it doesn't take a genius to say this, but you know, Leipzig have had very little in terms of plan B when they go behind and they need to, you know, and the other team just kind of holds up. That has been missing, and I think that's why, you know, you need Nagelsmann, because he has those ideas, he has those solutions, and he's proven, he's turned guys from nobodies virtually into all Bundesliga, German national team members, and you know, I think, you know, every Hoffenheim player probably donate like half of their salary or their contracts to Nagelsmann for eternity. So I think there will be a three-horse race, and then you never know with Peter Bosz. I mean, that's the nice thing, you know, they are losing Brandt, but they're getting Kerem Demirbay, who, you know, a different type of player, but maybe they can even get more out of Kai Havertz, and you know, they didn't get that much out of Bailey and Bellarabi, who had been hurt. So that could be a dark horse team, because, you know, Peter Bosz this season has shown me that he can change. I mean, he has learned from the mistakes. I mean, he has a different system now, you know, with the 3-6-1, and it's not just the same, like, you know, smash mouth. I mean, they are still dominating teams, but it's also now they're getting really, especially down the stretch, they're super hard to counter. So I was one of my predictions that I got wrong, that they're going to be great. And I think that it's going to continue next season.
Yeah, I would tend to agree that there could be other teams who have something to say. I'm also very interested to see how things develop in Gladbach under Marco Rose. I mean, I think that the fact that they didn't make it into the Champions League this season is going to leave a pretty ugly taste in their mouth, but I think that there is every reason to think that, you know, they have a good chance to improve next season. All right, let's take a little palate cleanser, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about our teams and players and coaches of the season. All right, let's wrap up talking foosball for the week, and in fact, talking foosball for the season, by looking back at who we thought were the very best of the season in various categories. We have, you know, teams of the season. We have age classes, NBA style categories like most improved player, and then we sort of just talk about who's just the plain best player of the season. That will be closing things out. I thought, just as a sort of thought experiment slash playing field leveler, we should do teams of the season in the following way, which is to say the Bayern Dortmund 11 and the everybody else 11. Maybe I'm wrong in thinking that, but I just thought that it would have skewed so heavily toward Bayern and Dortmund anyway if we tried to do a plain old best 11 of the season. I mean, I don't know how many people outside of those two teams would have made it into the 11. I thought we should just sort of accept that reality and give them separate categories.
Yeah, I mean, I like that one as well. One of the things we did on the TV show was we did like a team of the season where you could only use like one player, which I think was a Twitter idea.
Yep, from each team.
Yeah, and we got some interesting themes, and it was weird because at some point you can only, like, I think the tough part with those is you can only like pick one Bayern player or one Leipzig, but then like there's like six teams where it's like pretty easy that you're gonna pick Grifo from Freiburg and whatnot. But for the Bayern Dortmund 11, I think we were in pretty decent agreement that Birki was our keeper. I don't think you can really make a case for.
Yeah.
Although, like, interestingly, like, both he and Neuer had the same amount of clean sheets, which you know, clean sheets, you know, I think Birki was definitely the better keeper.
I think his sheets were cleaner.
Yeah, for sure. And it's like, you know, he also made some ridiculous saves, and, you know, Neuer definitely had more big mistakes. And for right back, Kimmich, I think, is no contest. Süle has to be in there as one of the center backs. I don't think there's a second Bayern center back that we could use, because it's like you talked about NBA. I mean, Mats Hummels and Jerome Boateng are both the all offense, no defense. It's like they're like the Kobe Bryant of all defense. Like, Kobe Bryant kept making all defense teams when he couldn't play any defense. It's like, that's how you could, there's the only way you could put in like Hummels and Boateng here. But so I went for Akanji, who was fairly solid. I mean, he probably gets some points deducted for how Dortmund's Rukrunda went. I think that's pretty good. And then we disagreed about the left back spot. I picked Hakimi just because, like, his impact was huge. Although he, you know, obviously got injured towards the end, and then even before his injury, he was not that great. But I don't know.
Yeah, no, those were exactly the points that I sort of deducted for him. He sort of, both injury kept him out for a while, and for all the good that he brought to that team, he also had a couple of games where he played a big part in Dortmund dropping points. So I just felt like it was hard to look past a guy like David Alaba, who has been so good for so long and was good again this year.
Yeah, I guess I was just looking at it as like the most minutes he's played since, it goes back a while, but since a long time. And, you know, he missed only three games, I think, and up there, most expected goals since, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, most expected assists. So quietly, highest XG chain. So quietly had a pretty. I mean, it's a weird with Alaba because everybody just compares him to his 2013 self, and you know, he hasn't gotten back to those levels. But it'll be good enough for us. I think in midfield we don't really have a choice. It's got to be like Witzel and Thiago, right?
I mean, yeah.
Those would be like that. I think both would be in the team of the season.
Oh, I think so for sure. And I think, you know, if only a team had those two guys together, if only they played on the same national team or some such, that would be a really, really great sort of bedrock to put your team on.
Yeah.
Because they have really complementary skills.
And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Witzel maybe dropped off a little bit in the recruitment there, but still, I thought he was, you know, he's got like this crazy stat where it's like 62% of his dribbles are successful, and he's a central midfielder, and I just think it's just really, really hard to get off the ball. It seems like a Belgian thing, because like Moussa Dembélé is the other one where it's like, if you're a Belgian center mid, like no one's taking the ball from you. But yeah, I guess midfield and like wide forwards, I guess we have Sancho, Royce. I think those got to be shoe-ins, right? And then I picked Gnabry, who quietly, I mean, not so quietly, I think, you know, it's not that quiet once Uli Hoeneß mentions your name. So he had a pretty big season, and you could argue. I mean, I had this argument with my co-host yesterday that he liked Goretzka as the signing, one of the signings of the season. And I thought like Gnabry, even though like I guess he's not technically a new signing because he was on loan last year, but I think he's a much better candidate for that.
Yeah, and as much as I like Gnabry, I also feel that Kingsley Coman made a pretty good case for himself in that as well. Yeah. And I think he could have squeezed into that team as well.
He's the winner of this year's Lars Bender Award for kickers, best rated player, outfield player, because he had like 18 appearances. You know, this is a weird thing with kicker because, you know, you only have to play half the games.
Right,
so
exactly.
He played like 18, I think, or maybe he started 18, but like he's got the best average of the outfield players.
I think he was rated in 20 or something like that.
Yeah. Even in the whole Bundesliga. So it's probably, I mean, you know, it's not his fault that, you know, I think in the first game of the season he got crushed by Nico Schulz and then he was out for a long time. And yeah, I don't mind. I would have to look at like the minutes distribution, but I think Gnabry to me had a greater impact. And then up top, it was, I think, a tough decision. I guess even before up top, like Thomas Müller, I want to give kind of a shout out to, because of all players in the Rückrunde, he was number one in expected assists, which is, you know, basically like a modeled version of expected goals boiled down to key passes and whatnot. And so expected assists, he was leading every player in the Rückrunde and ended up with, I think, 9 assists overall. So it quietly had a very nice second half of the season. And, you know, but I just don't think I could take out any of the other guys. And up top, as much as, I mean, I got some flack yesterday on the TV show for not including Paco Alcácer in any of the awards. And it's like, I don't have a vendetta against him, but, you know, and his impact was huge, but he's played like 1180 minutes. And I think that's great that he's scoring 18 goals, but that we still don't know if he's probably not a regular starter. I mean, that's the crazy thing. So, and there's no way he can make it over Lewandowski.
No. Lewandowski is at the top of the heap in the Bayern Dortmund 11. The everybody else 11, I think, got a little bit more complicated, but there were plenty of shoe-ins. I think Peter Gulacsi was, you know, a pretty clear favorite for that. In the back line, we both had Konate, Hasebe, and Roussillon, which, you know, we both had them. We agree. I was interested that you went for a player from my team as your right back, which, you know, a guy who he was maybe my favorite player for Hertha, but I didn't pick him in mine.
Like, I don't really think there's a good right back option. I mean, like, the right back options are depth is like Kimmich, and then like, you know, like, you know how they make those memes about like Manchester City, Liverpool, and the gap between Chelsea, like on Twitter? Like, imagine those, like that space, like the 20, and then that's where you have like Valentino Lazaro or like, you know, like Piszczek. Like, I don't think there's very many good right backs in the Bundesliga. So we'll see. So that's why I have him there. I can't really think of anybody else. I didn't want to play 3 in the back. And I guess, yeah. I don't know. Maybe Klostermann, I guess, now that I think about it, could have been there. But then
I put in Danny DaCosta.
Yeah, that's a good one. But I don't like Danny DaCosta as a, in the four,
yeah,
in the four defender setup. But yeah, that probably would have been a smarter choice. So I yield to you in that one.
Yeah, I didn't want to get too strict with the formation. We had it looks as here's sort of like a three central midfielder thing going on, which I think is probably more in service of getting more of our favorite slash most highly regarded players into the side than also being all that strict about formation. We both had Kerim Demirbay and Julian Brandt, who, of course, will be, not robbed of the chance to play together next season in that, yeah. Just as Demirbay is coming into Leverkusen, Julian Brandt is leaving. Your choice for another midfielder was Maximilian Eggestein. I went for Nico Schulz, who, obviously this is not a like-for-like situation. I wanted to find a place to get Schulz into my team because I felt like...
Yeah, I think I like him as well. I mean, he was somebody that was running super, super unlucky with the assists because for like, I think the Hinrunde, he had like 7 or 8 expected assists and had like 1 or 2, which sums up Hoffenheim's season with the post 27 times and was like 20 goals under their XG. So, and I think poor Nico Schulz was like... robbed of 10 assists at least by Salahi and Belfodil and Kramaric and I guess some other guys. Yeah, I just wanted to reward some Werder player because I like them this season and I couldn't really think of anybody else. And Eggestein was carrying them in the early parts of the season and I don't really think he really dropped off. It was just more like he was scoring long range goals and then he wasn't. So I like that one. I guess Kevin Campbell is somebody that I always like and try to get him onto these teams.
Yeah.
And then I guess in front of this three, we have Kai Havertz, who I think would be again, same thing I said earlier about, Royce and Sancho and some of the other guys, he would be in the teams of the season.
Yeah. He's one of the guys who would have probably cracked even the overall team of the season, leaving out our Bayern Dortmund and everybody else separation. I mean, he's pretty bulletproof at this point.
Yeah, and I mean, a surefire probably, if you had to bet on anybody to be the next dominant German superstar, I mean, it's got to be him. And, we had some issues. I think in the forward line is interesting. I would have, we could have put, the same way you put Da Costa in, we could have put Kostic in there. But yeah, the left wing is a super interesting, the left sort of attacking wing back, full back, Schulz, Roussillon, Kostic. There's a lot of Halstenberg, a lot of really good ones this year, but I didn't put them. So I left out Kramaric because he, I think, cost Hoffenheim a lot of things. I mean, he was second in the league in expected goals. A lot of those are penalties, though. But he, had like 6 or 7 epic misses from seemingly unmissable situations. Kevin Folland is kind of an honorable mention. So my pick ahead of Havertz is Jovic and Belfodil. And you can substitute Jovic for somebody like Poulsen or Wout Weghorst, I guess, to put another Wolfsburg player in there. But I would like to put Belfodil in there because it's just one of those guys that nobody really expected that much of. And I actually predicted this his transfer to Hoffenheim like 3 weeks before it happened. So I didn't think it would just go.
Yeah, I think what you recognized at that time was that this is a player who needs a lot of improvement. And where do you go to get that? You go to Hoffenheim.
University of Nagelsmann.
Exactly. Has been moved to Leipzig in the offseason. Newcomer of the season. We had, a lot of players to choose from.
Yeah.
Truthfully, I felt like more than maybe in some years in recent memory, there were...
It might have been the hardest category.
Yeah. I guess we can pick... Let's do one for each position, maybe. Defenders, midfielders, forwards. Because there were no new good goalkeepers, let's just face it.
Yeah, I put Alex Nubo. I guess he played a little bit last year, maybe once or twice. So, but not too many other ones.
It's sort of his award by default.
Yeah,
in a way.
Not really anything else. And defenders, I think Roussillon for me would be the one to pick over Hakimi, just because the body of work was longer. In terms of midfield, I feel bad about picking Axel Witsel because he's a newcomer, but he's been around. I mean, so I like Tyler Adams there. He's only played half a year, but I think that was your choice, right? I quite like that one.
Yeah. No, I hesitate to necessarily plump for him too hard because I think he only had 10 games or something like that. But
those are some good
games.
They were
great.
Yeah.
I mean, I was looking at, to go back to kicker ratings, which are, you know, of variable importance slash accuracy. But he I think he probably would have been the fifth or sixth highest rated midfielder in the league if he had kept on that clip throughout the season. So I would definitely look at him as next year somebody who, if he has a good year, could get into a, you know, team of the season situation. He was that good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've gone to pine a little bit for Benito Raman, just because I guess he's technically a midfielder, although he plays as a forward a lot, just because he came on really strong and everybody talks about Luke Bacchio. And I think Raman was just as good, but, you know, didn't get all those headlines.
Yeah, well, and also he just gets so many touches. I mean, he's so central to what they do. He can be a bit of a ball hog, but, you know, he gets things done. I guess Alisson Plea is another interesting person where, you know, he had such a good first half of the season.
Yeah, if this was at, like, December, he would have run away with this. Yeah.
And what do you think of my notion that Joel Linton should be eligible for this award? Because he barely played for Hoffenheim 3 years ago.
He was gone in Austria
for two seasons. So I basically think he deserves a fresh start, and he was really good.
No, I like that one. Yeah, I like that one.
Maybe a little overlap in some of our previous awards. Most improved player. The guy who I really think sort of, he wasn't coming from a low level. He was already a good player, but the one who sort of really became a serious force for me was Yusuf Poulsen.
Yeah, that's a great
support striker for several years.
Couldn't score.
And now he very much can score. And I think that's going to be key for them going ahead.
Apparently, like, he's worked with a psychologist. There was some article about that that's really helped him. And I it's a tremendous improvement because I think he's never scored more than 5 goals, and he was at like 8 or 9 goals, like after a few weeks, so it's maybe 10 weeks. So yeah, and you know, had the same. He can play out wide. I mean, he's fast. He can finish. I mean, it's tremendous. And I, you know, now he's gonna get the Nagelsmann boost. So I mean, that's gonna be tremendous. I went with Milot Rashica just because, like, he's somebody who wasn't good enough to play for Bremen because of his defensive work. And then, you know, for the first 7-8 weeks of the Rückrunde, was maybe the best player, maybe not in the league, but the best player outside of Bayern and Dortmund. So I like him a lot. Belfodil, we mentioned. And Sancho is like super overqualified for this most improved player role.
Yeah. It is worth remembering, though, that last season he was really just a bit player for Dortmund, a guy who showed flashes but was nowhere near what he turned into this season. So it is very apt.
You and I were together watching the Sancho show against Hertha Berlin last season. It seemed like 10 years ago. But when Peter Stöger's tactics was basically give every ball to Sancho and let him destroy poor Mitchell Weiser, which he did promptly.
Well, a lot of people destroyed Mitchell Weiser for Hertha last season.
That's true, but that was unfair. So, one positive memory of Stöger ball.
Yeah. The only other name that I sort of wanted to squeeze in here was Alexander Dragovic, who...
Really?
He was... Well, just because he was so horrible. He was okay, so horrible when he was like in his first season for Leverkusen. Left, you know, he was basically cast off. And, you know, they said, Leicester, you can have him for a year. Please take him away. They didn't want him. He came back. And it turned out he actually had a pretty good year. So I don't want to say he was like an absolute stud or anything, but he went from being dreadful to being, you know, quite a capable Bundesliga center back.
Now, I really like some of your other nominees here. Like you have Jonas Hofmann, who was a completely transformative player for Hecking in the first half of the season. And then you have Vincenzo Grifo, which just, you know, warms my heart because I think I've taken over the Vincenzo Grifo bandwagon from, I think Ted Knudsen is the one, the Statsbaum founder who started it. But I think now I've taken over the reins from him. He's a busy man. So that's great. And it's all made possible by the injury to Hungary's Roland Schalai, who, you know, otherwise they wouldn't have gotten him from what I found out in Freiburg, is that they really only picked up Grifo from Hoffenheim because Schalai got hurt. And now I think we're all the better for it. And really, like, that disproves our theory about Nagelsmann, because somehow Grifo is maybe the only player that didn't work out under him.
Yeah. A couple of age categories, and I think these two are pretty easy. At least the under 21 player of the season,
yeah.
Jadon Sancho, Kai Havertz. I mean, these are not only under 21 players of the season for the Bundesliga. These are
player of the season,
world under 21 players.
Yeah,
of the season
pretty much.
After
yeah,
I mean, other than you know, Mbappe. I mean, these are probably maybe the two best under 21 players in the world at the moment. So
if you had to like draft somebody, like for the next 15 years, you know, career kind of like, you probably would take those three, right? In some order.
Yeah. Yeah. I think those will be the guys on the, you know, Ballon d'Or podium in, you know, 6 or 7 years time. Again and again and again.
Yeah, I put like Jean-Philippe Mateta, who I don't particularly like, just because really the only thing he does is score, which is not bad from a striker, but like he's kind of not great at everything else, but you know, quietly had a very nice goal scoring season.
Yeah. The über 30 player of the season, which, you know, in my world,
to
be over 30, you have to be actually over 30. So 31 or higher. So I'm going to disqualify Robert Lewandowski,
who
you tried to squeeze in here, and Finn Bogason as well. I guess I would have to go with Łukasz Piszczek. I think he really had one of his, you know, not only best seasons performance-wise, but he was one of the guys kind of holding things together.
Yeah, when he was healthy,
They really needed him to have a good season, and he did.
He was great. I like your choices. I mean, you have Hasebe, which is probably the right way to go here. I don't really like mine too much. I've got Ibišević and Kalou, who's, you know, blah. You know, I mean, it's not bad, of course. And then Max Kruse, maybe Max Kruse, you know, should get some kind of award because, you know, maybe not so quietly, but 11 goals, 9 assists, getting a big contract. We're not sure where, you know, hopefully, I don't know. I mean, last I heard he was talking with Frankfurt, but then, you know, I also looked at the Max Kruse rumors page and it was just every club in the world mentioned. So that to say, I mean, there's a lot of poker tables and I don't know how the Frankfurt Pat Limit Omaha games are. Maybe you could talk about that, but we could always, you know, we always need to squeeze Max Kruse in there somehow.
Exactly. There's so much lore surrounding this guy and his bag of money in the taxi and his, you know, some spicy FaceTiming. He's everywhere you want him to be.
I mean, if he goes to Frankfurt, I can promise that I will try everything to get an interview. I mean, Frankfurt are probably very accommodating and great people and the wonderful club. So I just for that, I want that to happen. You know, spend some of that Jovic money on him.
All right. So we're down to one last award. That is just plain player of the season. No improvement, no newcomer, no under or over age. Just, you know, who was the guy when you look back on this season that you will say is the one who sort of left the biggest mark and had the most big performances?
It's really weird. Like, this is something that I still don't have a good answer to. Like, I've been asked this question a few times now, and this is one of those where I'm going to, like, save myself a couple of hours and maybe thousands of words of research and probably just pick Sancho. Because of, like, to go from being a nice dribbling player who had a huge upside to put up like astonishing numbers. And you know, I think a kicker has him at 18 assists. Other sites have him at 14 or 16 or whatever. And they have the 12 goals. I mean, that's the other thing. And he's just somebody like, I mean, Neymar is always the guy they compare him to. Just someone who can, there's so few guys in football who can just destroy a game plan, just destroy, you know, any matchup. And he's still got, you know, a fairly good amount to learn against the ball and, you know, with decision making, but he's also just explosive, mature. I mean, you know, the personal note that I have is probably one of the personal highlights of my season was getting to go to Leverkusen and watch that 4-2 comeback for Dortmund where I was talking with a lot of the colleagues. I think John Harding was there, Matthew Marshall, some of these other guys, and they were down 2-0 at halftime, and I was like, well, they're Dortmund are not coming back here. And then they brought in Sancho, who was, you know, this is hard to it's easy to forget now, but he was a reserve player, and, you know, changed the game with Alcácer, who also had two goals. And then we were talking to him in the mix zone. And, you know, when we're talking, German reporters and journalists are asking him questions about what's it like being a joker. And, you know, obviously in German, the joker is a sort of the super sub. And he just didn't understand, you know, what it meant. It had to be explained to him. So to come from that, and this was late September, you know, when Dortmund's season started to take off. I mean, it was, you know, so poor that Hans-Joachim Watzke would refuse to talk to us because the season was not going so well prior to that. And you know, to go from that and to be, you know, to go on that terror of just like destroying the league and you know, what he did to Bayern, you know, what he did to Mats Hummels in that game, and just everywhere. So I will remember that. And you know, this is not a slide to Kai Havertz, who would be second on my list, or Lewandowski, who, you know, to quietly sort of had another great season where he's become a key passing master. Or you know, even like a Thiago, who's always one of my favorites. You know, Royce, who I think Royce, had he not missed those 8 or 9 games in the recruitment, probably would have won this award for me.
Yeah. No, it's funny. You've gone through pretty much the exact same group of players who I was, and you know, for sentimental reasons, I both at the halfway point in the season and now I sort of, in a lot of ways, wanted to give it to Marco Reus because Dortmund were having this season that they were having, and because Marco Reus was, up until that last bit where he was having difficulty staying healthy, was really playing consistently and playing well. But I can't not pick Sancho. I can't. Because I think that whatever happens in this season, the next season, the season after that, you know, we mentioned it already. This guy is going to be a world football sort of icon. And this was basically his breakout season. This was the season where he turned into an unplayable player. So to not give this award to him just because I sentimentally want to give it to Royce, or because Lewandowski won the title, I can't do it. Sancho is the guy. Okay, that is it for this edition of Talking Foosball, which, you know, as always, was produced by Aidan Rantoul. It was really nice to have you back on the pod, Abel. Were you sufficiently, you know, rested to have your last pod appearance of the season? Or are you sort of still a little bit teary about it, about everything's coming to a close?
I think I'm still, like, desperately clinging on to the idea that as long as this podcast is running, we still have Bundesliga to talk about and then not have to go into the summer break. So maybe that's why, you know, I've gotten excited for this. But yeah, so I guess still not rested. I'm still restless, more like it.
Yeah, I think I'll let you put that apt correction to my sentence. You can find Abel on Twitter if you want to reach out and touch him at BundesPL. He also has a superior Bundesliga bulletin, is the name of it, mailing list that he puts a lot of effort and love into each week. You know, who knows what its status is will be over the summer. Talking Foosball status over the summer will probably be pretty intermittent. If we come up with ideas that seem like a fun thing to talk about, we will hit you with some more content, perhaps just bonus content on Patreon, who can say. If you want to hit me up on Twitter, I'm at Mr. Matt Herman. Please do subscribe to the podcast on your podcasting platform of choice. Do leave us a rating. Tell all your friends. All of those things are a big help. Anyway, bis zum nächsten Mal, y'all.